From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Coral reefs are among the clearest harbingers of climate change. That's because they live at the upper end of their thermal spectrum, which means they're sensitive to slight changes. When water is too warm, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, corals expel the algae that lives in their tissues. That causes them to turn white, which doesn't always mean that they're dead. Coral bleaching can also happen if water gets too cold, as it did in the Florida Keys in 2010, when the ocean temperature dropped by 12 degrees. But there is a worldwide die-off of corals underway. Scientists are looking for causes, some of which are clear. Not all of them are. Today, we're going to explore what some of those causes are of coral deaths. We'll also find out what role sponges play in the ecosystem, whose populations grow more robust as corals die. And we'll learn about new techniques that scientists are experimenting with to save coral populations. Joe Pollack is the Frank Hawkins Keenan Distinguished Professor of Marine Biology at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology. Joe Pollack, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having us, Rachel.
And Nikki Fogarty is a professor in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology, where she studies coral reef ecology. Welcome to the program, Nikki Fogarty.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have both of you here. And we're inviting you to join the conversation during the live Wednesday discussion. What have you always wanted to understand about coral reefs and sponges? You can call us during the live discussion on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Professor Nikki Fogarty, you study specifically anthropogenic stressors that are killing coral reefs. What are those stressors? And are coral reef mortality rates largely driven by those stressors, human-caused stressors?
Yes, they seem to be. We study a variety of different stressors, anything from the effects of various sex steroids that enter the ocean through various pollutant sources. We study sedimentation and how it affects corals. And we also study ocean warming and ocean acidification and its effect on the earliest life history stages of the corals as well as the adults.
So from where you sit, how would you say the ocean has changed over the last several decades?
It's changed in a variety of different ways, particularly increasing in temperature. And the increase in temperature can lead to the breakdown of the coral symbiotic algae. So there's algae that live in the tissues of the coral, and they provide the coral most of its nutrition. So when the coral experiences stress, a lot of times it's based on increased temperature, then this symbiotic relationship breaks down. And you might have heard the term coral bleaching before. So the coral kicks out the symbiotic algae, and the algae gives the coral its beautiful color, the golden hues, brownish hues. And when they kick out that algae, you just see the white skeleton through its translucent tissues. So it looks bleached. But it doesn't always lead, as you mentioned, to mortality. At the very least, though, it's going to decrease the growth rates, calcification rates, and reproduction rates.
How do you know when a coral is actually dead?
So you know, they're very slimy animals, and you can actually see the polyps if you look closely. So if it's dead, the skeleton is going to be very dry and hard. It's not going to have that veneer of coral tissue, and you won't be able to see the extended polyps and their little tentacles.
And okay, so you just referred to a coral as an animal.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because there might be people who are surprised to hear that a coral, I mean, everyone knows they're alive and they die, but they might not think of them as animals.
Yes, and I often get this question. They are animals. A lot of people think they're just rocks, but they are animals that are closely related to things like sea anemones, Portuguese man-o-war, and jellyfish. They're all in the same phylum, and all of which have stinging cells. But the coral colony itself is made up of a bunch of little polyps that look like tiny little sea anemones. So you're probably familiar with that from Finding Nemo. And so they have these little tentacles, and they are alive. They are animals. And so if you look closely, you can see the little polyps protruding from their calcium carbonate skeleton.
And how do they reproduce?
They reproduce in two different ways, one of which is asexual reproduction, where if a storm comes through, a piece might break off, and then that little piece reattaches to the bottom and starts to grow. And that little piece is genetically identical from the parent colony that it broke off from. But they also produce sexually, just like humans. They produce eggs and sperm. And most of the corals are what we call broadcast spawning hermaphrodites. So they produce both egg and sperm. And they release their egg and sperm bundles. And once a year, an amazing coral spawning event. And so that coral bundle that's a package of egg and sperm floats to the surface, breaks apart, and then that's where fertilization occurs. And then the resulting embryos float for several days, form a little planula larvae that swims down to the bottom, looks for a good place to settle, and then goes through a process called metamorphosis, just like a caterpillar into a butterfly. And in this case, it goes from a larva to a little coral polyp, again, that's reminiscent of a little sea anemone. And then hopefully it can survives and grows and into an adult and starts the cycle all over again.
Is that something you can observe with the human eye? Can you see?
Yes, and it's an amazing experience to see coral spawning. If you ever get an opportunity or even go Google it, it's pretty spectacular. It looks like this huge snowstorm of pink little spheres in the water, and it's amazing that these relatively simple animals can reproduce simultaneously once a year in this magnificent form.
Joe Pollack, you study sponges, and we'll talk about the fact that the population of sponges seems to have an inverse correlation to the population of corals. But first, tell us what you've seen in terms of the differences in the ocean floor in different parts of the world, because you've been to the Red Sea, but you study the Caribbean.
Right. Well, I've been diving since the late 70s, and, you know, it's always hard to remember things too far back, but coral cover was certainly much higher in all of the places I dove back in the 80s and early 90s. But I've been fortunate to be able to study the same place, which is a reef off of Key Largo, Florida, called Conch Reef, since about 1992. And even though that reef was never had really high coral cover, the changes there have been pretty dramatic over the intervening decades with the continued loss of coral cover. While we've been doing those studies, we started monitoring individual giant barrel sponges at that site. And that's turned out to be a very interesting project that requires just essentially going around and looking at things and measuring them. So it's not very technologically advanced. But what we discovered was over the last 10 years or so, 122% increase in the total number of those sponges and a 40% increase in the overall biomass or the volume of the tissue of those giant barrel sponges.
So they not only proliferate, the individual sponges get bigger.
Right, right. And we were just there a month ago, and this was the first time I've been back since Hurricane Irma hit the Florida Keys. And we had heard that a lot of the sponges had been damaged by the storm, so we were anxious to see what had taken place. And what we discovered was that many of them survived with no problem. Many lost tissue but quickly regenerated. But the astonishing thing was that many of the large barrel sponges that had been completely ripped off the reef had already started redeveloping tissue from their base and were re-aggregating to form sponges again. So the tissue that's at the very base essentially just starts growing directly from the bottom.
So, what kind of a time frame are we talking about? When did Irma hit Florida?
A year and a half.
So it's within it's that year and
within,
a half.
Within
that's
that year
happened.
And a half, yeah. Yeah, so they're extremely resilient, and that's part of the issue with, you know, corals are much less resilient when it comes to these kinds of abuses. But the sponges seem to take that in stride, and in fact, very often reproduce in the manner that Nikki explained, where Asexual reproduction takes place when the sponges fragment. So just like corals, the sponges will break up and regrow.
And just describe for us what a giant barrel sponge looks like.
You can see nice videos of them at my YouTube channel, which is Pollock Lab.
Which we will also link to when this goes up on our website.
Yeah, they can get huge. They can get the size of literally a VW bus on end in places where the sponges have been allowed to grow to ages that we have estimated in the thousands of years. They never seem to get that old off the coast of Florida, but imagine a small waste basket or the largest that we would have would be the size of a yard waste basket, a plastic barrel. And in appearance, sort of an off brownish red color with a central open cylinder, and then the walls of it are, you know, sort of like a peaked volcano almost. So does that sound
yes,
like something?
Yes, this is very evocative, but I'm just wondering how the sponge might feel about being compared to a wastebasket.
Yeah, the size is mostly
right.
Yeah.
Which leads to the next question about the inverse correlation between the coral population and the sponge population. When we come back from this break, we're going to find out not only why that is, but whether the proliferation of sponges is not a good thing. I think Joe Pollock has some thoughts about that. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of coral reefs and sponges. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call at 910-343-1138. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. When coral reefs die, sponges seem to proliferate. Today, we're going to find out what that could mean for the ocean's ecosystem. Two marine scientists are with us, Nikki Fogarty and Joe Pollock, are professors in UNCW's biology and marine biology department. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. So Joe Pollock, when corals die off, sponges proliferate. Why?
Well, first and foremost, sponges and seaweeds and corals, those are the three big players in a coral reef ecosystem, all compete for one resource, and that is space. When sponges or when corals die, they release the space, which is their skeleton. And so the first group right off the bat that takes over that space is usually seaweeds, because seaweeds grow really rapidly and they reproduce really rapidly. So they're truly weedy. The sponges respond more slowly. But what we're starting to realize is that we always looked at sponges as being primarily particle feeders, that they eat, they use these tiny little flagellated cells in their bodies to draw particles into their bodies and then eat those particles. And what's becoming really clear is that a major component of their diet are not particles at all, but instead something that we call dissolved organic carbon. So if you think about the sugar in your coffee as a dissolved organic carbon source, just like you can drink your coffee and metabolize that sugar, sponges are doing the same thing. And what we're finding a link to is that the seaweeds, when they're exposed to bright sunlight, are actually producing sugar very much like the sugar that's in your coffee. And the sponges are eating that sugar as it's being produced. And the sponges are peeing, they're releasing nutrients, and that is essentially fertilizing the algae. So what you have is a feedback loop between the algae, the seaweeds, and the sponges, and both of them are growing faster because of it, and excluding more space for corals. And not just the corals that have died, but as Nikki explained, the babies have to find, baby corals have to find a new place to live. And if all of the occupied territory is taken up by sponges and seaweeds, you're not going to have a coral reef anymore.
Is that bad? What do we lose, Nikki Fogarty, if we lose more coral reefs?
Well, coral reefs are tremendously important, not only to our economy, but so for instance, it's estimated that the global value of coral reefs is $30 billion, and that's on the low end.
How do you put a dollar amount on that?
Folks have studied this, and let me break it down for you so you get an idea of how you do put a dollar on that. First of all, roughly about $6 billion is from the biodiversity associated with the reef. Another $6 billion is the seafood industry. $9 billion is attributed to tourism. Another $9 billion is attributed to shoreline protection. So, and these figures don't even include some of the medicines that we can get from the reef. There have been a lot of different compounds extracted from coral reef ecosystems, the different organisms that live there, and they've been used for pain management, cancer-fighting drugs, and there are several in development for Alzheimer's, antimicrobial properties, a lot of various diseases that humans experience. We can get pharmaceutical agents from coral reefs.
Are there pharmacological uses, Joe Pollack, for the chemicals that the sponges are peeing?
Yes, actually, that they're peeing?
Are those different things, chemicals that they're emitting and then the waste product that comes out?
Yes. The chemicals that they're emitting are not too dissimilar to what we emit when we urinate. Essentially, it's sponge pee. But within the tissues of many sponges are some really unusual metabolites, which are what Nikki was referring to. And these are called secondary metabolites or natural products. They're not involved in the primary metabolic functions of the sponge. And they may have a whole host of functions, or they may not, but what chemists have been interested in is whether some of those compounds could have medicinal properties. And so since the 1950s, people have been extracting the tissue of sponges, and sponges are, in fact, one of the best potential sources of new drugs because they have such bizarre chemistry in them. And one of the reasons for that is that the diversity of sponges on coral reefs is so great. There are over 500 species of sponges just on Caribbean reefs, and that's an estimate because we don't know.
Just on Caribbean reefs?
Just on Caribbean
reefs.
You've
said that Caribbean reefs are less biodiverse than reefs in other parts of the world.
Right. In fact, in the Indo-Pacific, we don't even know the names of the sponges. There are so many of them. And the sponge biologists that have studied Indo-Pacific systems claim that you can go from bay to bay and pick up different species of sponges. There's that much species diversity. And we think we know why this is, because sponges don't need to be exposed to light. So the seaweeds and corals, the two other big players on reefs, have to have sunlight in order to survive. But sponges don't. They can live down in the interstices of the reef and at low levels.
In the what of the reef?
Sorry, in the little cracks and crevices.
What's the word that you used?
Oh, interstices.
How do you spell that?
It's like interstitial music. You know
okay.
what that is,
sure.
right?
Yeah,
okay. It's the same root.
I can relate to that. But,
yeah.
Okay, in the little cracks and crevices of
right.
the reef.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so they're basically hiding out down there, so nobody can drive them to extinction by predation or anything like that. So you wind up with this hyper-diverse community, of which maybe only 15 or 20 species are dominant, and those are the ones that are out on the reef at any given time. So that level of biodiversity over long periods of time means that all of those individual species may have evolved their own set of chemistry in the process of evolving over hundreds of millions of years, and therefore are different sources of potential drugs.
And there's an advantage for you as a scientist in studying a reef in the Caribbean that is less biodiverse.
Correct, because we can understand the system better because there are fewer players. even though there's all that biodiversity of sponges. Actually, they're just 10 sponges make up over 50% of the cover and biomass of sponges on any given Caribbean reef. And you can go anywhere in the Caribbean and find the same players. If you try to do that in the Indo-Pacific, you can't. It's very diverse. So, you know, ecologists like to name the individual organisms that they're dealing with. And when you can't do that, it makes it more difficult to do a study that means anything.
Nikki Fogarty, when you were talking about the dollar value of the coral reefs around the world, you said a big chunk of that is attributed to shoreline protection.
That's right.
How do coral reefs protect the shoreline?
So as I mentioned before, corals are animals, but they build a skeleton, calcium carbonate skeleton. And over long periods of time, it continues to grow and build very complex reefs. And when the large waves roll up to the shorelines, they hit the coral reef first, breaking them up. And so there's lower wave energy on the inside of coral reefs. And so that helps protect our properties that are along the coastline and also protects the beaches as well.
So it protects the beaches from erosion and also protects any infrastructure that might have been built up.
That's correct.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the ecosystem of coral reefs and sponges. With us to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Joe Pollack and Nikki Fogarty. They're professors in UNCW's Biology and Marine Biology Department. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. There is a disease running rampant that scientists know about now called stony coral tissue loss disease.
Correct.
What is that, and what are you trying to understand about it?
So unfortunately, we don't know the pathogen. We don't know what causes it. First appeared about 2014 off of Miami, and it spread throughout the Florida Keys and off of Fort Lauderdale as well within the past 5 years. And it's just devastated corals. There's about 60 species of corals in the Caribbean, and this is affecting over 20 of those. So nearly a third of the corals are being affected by this disease. Background disease levels are usually 2-3% on a reef. And what we're seeing now is the prevalence of this disease in the Florida Keys, for instance, of 66-100%. So it's shocking. This is an unprecedented breakout, and unfortunately, it is spreading to other parts of the Caribbean as well. Jamaica, U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Martin, Dominican Republic, even over to Mexico have observed this disease.
Do we know what it is?
We don't know the pathogen. People are working on that, but we don't know the pathogen on most coral diseases. There are some that are linked to bacteria. Some of the soft coral diseases are linked to a fungus. But for the most part, it's really challenging to identify the pathogen that's responsible. We're just seeing the signs of the disease, and they are similar across all these different species.
So when we think about the rate of coral die-offs, Joe Pollack, you've said that in the 80s, the rate of corals dying was actually much higher than it is today. So help us put that in the context of what's happening with this stony coral tissue loss disease.
Well, in fact, in the 80s was when the first wave of these kinds of diseases came through, and they affected, the first set affected the acroporid corals, which are the branching corals that used to be so beautiful on the inside of reefs and gave you the big elkhorn and staghorn-like looking corals. And they moved in exactly the same way that Nikki described. They started in certain places and then proceeded to move kind of clockwise around the Caribbean, ultimately causing cover area, cover of about 40-50% dropped to 20 and then down to 10% over a very short period of time. But interestingly, diseases beyond just those of corals have done similar things in the Caribbean, because at the same time, or shortly after the first breakouts of coral diseases, there was a devastating disease that killed all the long-spined black sea urchins. And those animals were very important to coral reef ecology in the Caribbean because they were major seaweed eaters. And that happened over the course of about a year and traveled the same route. And similarly, lionfish introduction traveled the same route. So we like to talk about the Caribbean as being like a mixing bowl, that you add something to it and it just mixes through the entire system over the course of a surprisingly small period of time, which is probably why you can pretty much go anywhere in the Caribbean and see the same organisms. It's because they're spread far, you know, within that system very efficiently.
And just briefly, what has the introduction of lionfish done to the Caribbean ecosystem?
Well, that's an area of some discussion. Initially, when they boomed, and they did, there was concern that they were going to wipe out a lot of the small fishes that frequent the reef and affect the ecosystem to an inordinate degree. What we're discovering is that it hasn't gone that bad. And interestingly, recently, lionfish populations seem to be declining rather abruptly, and we don't really know why. But they have not had as devastating an impact as we originally thought, and they may now be showing signs of their populations being reduced. And why is a good question.
All those lionfish cookbooks?
Definitely that's helped, but there are plenty of places where there's no one fishing them, and they've gone down there too. You know, variously people have thought that diseases of lionfish have been now introduced, that parasites of lionfish are now controlling them, that the predators have learned to take them now. Groupers and sharks are now feeding on them. In some cases, they've been trained to by dive groups, and that all of those things may now be in play.
Dive groups have trained predators to feed on lionfish?
Yes, by spearing them and then feeding them to the nurse sharks in particular. Then the nurse sharks essentially learn to eat the lionfish without needing to have them speared.
You mentioned the elkhorn and staghorn corals, and Nikki Fogarty, the hybridization of those corals is something that you've studied?
Yes, I've been studying that for about a decade now, and it's the only widely accepted natural occurring coral hybrid, and it occurs in the Caribbean. The staghorn elkhorns as a genus, there's over 150 species in the Indo-Pacific, but in the Caribbean, there's only two, and they hybridize. So as Joe is talking about, it's the Caribbean's highly simplified, so studying these type of things is much easier when you're looking at just two species.
And what is the hybridization of these corals doing to the rest of the ecosystem? What does it mean?
Well, that's still unclear, but we do see hybrids increasing in number in recent decades. That could be from a variety of different things. They could be more tolerant to the increase in temperature, something that I'm looking into. It could be that as the parental species have declined, their eggs go unfertilized, and so since they can hybridize whichever sperm they run into, if their own species or the other species, then it will actually form a hybrid. So
is that happening more often now?
It seems to be. So it's hard to tease apart that people are becoming more familiar with the hybrid. Before, they thought it was maybe a funky-looking staghorn coral. But now it seems at certain parts in the Caribbean where it's seeing the hybrid in higher abundance. Now, whether that's from increasing the rate of hybridization or it's just the hybrids are able to persist in this changing environment, that's still unclear.
Don wrote, is red coral real coral, and what causes its color?
I think he's talking about the coral that is used in making jewelry, and there are many corals that are used in making jewelry, but the coral that is used that's most valued is a deep water gorgonian. It's actually not a hexacoral, but an octacoral, and it is real coral. It's a cnidarian. But it grows very slowly at great depth, and when they bring up those trees of, this is the coral that gives the color coral its name. It's kind of a pinky red in color, and it grows like a tree, but it's very slow growing.
Now, Joe, you talked about how sponges emit chemicals, and some of those chemicals are being studied for pharmacological purposes. But what does that do? Does this mean that they're also just kind of pumping water through the organism? And if so, what does that do to the water around them? How does it change some of the smaller organisms that might be affected by, or larger organisms? Do they affect the organisms around them?
Well, it's something that we're working on, and that very little is known about. First of all, the chemicals that that are usually used for drug discovery are actually in the tissue. So they're not being emitted necessarily, although there is some evidence that in some cases, if they make mucus, it's in the mucus. But they these compounds are very valuable to the organism, so they're not generally liberated. It would be too expensive for the organism to just make it and liberate it. So generally, the compounds that come that are emitted are waste products. And those are usually things like ammonia, which is nitrogenous waste, and other compounds that are mostly ammonia is their primary waste source.
So when you add more ammonia, say, into this part of the ocean,
that's pollution, basically. That's a fertilizer for seaweed. So nitrogenous waste, but some of these compounds are quickly taken up by microbes or by phytoplankton. So. And you have to remember that coral reefs, four reefs, are under anywhere from, 10 to 50 meters of water. So there's plenty of buffer there for the phytoplankton to take up those sorts of things.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at the coral reef and ecosystem, coral reef and sponge ecosystem, specifically in the Caribbean, and what that might be telling us about climate change. You can ask your own question of UNCW professors Nikki Fogarty and Joe Pollack on this Wednesday, either by sending an email to coastline@whqr.org or by calling us at 910-343-1138. When we come back from this break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your own question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Coral reefs are dying around the world. The die-off is so widespread that researchers are no longer just hoping to preserve the ocean environment. They're working with reefs in labs using experimental ways of preserving those populations. Two marine scientists from UNCW are with us today. Nikki Fogarty and Joe Pollack are professors in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology, and they're answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can ask your own question or make a comment by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also call us at 910-343-1138. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get that question or comment in during the live edition. During the break, I admitted some pretty serious confusion about what we're talking about here in terms of corals and coral reefs and when a coral becomes a reef or what actually a coral reef is. So, Nikki Fogarty, what is one coral versus corals? And when are corals a reef or are those different structures?
So, an individual coral is a discrete unit, I guess, that is not, that you can see a definitive break between other corals, okay? So that would be considered a coral colony. Then once you have many of those, then it forms a coral reef and provides a larger structure that provides habitat for a variety of different animals, many of which are commercially valuable. So it's an individual coral is one thing, but when they become numerous, then it's termed more of a coral reef.
Joe Pollack.
Well, yeah, and this gets to a matter of semantics, because the geologists have kind of a different view of what a coral reef is. It has to have been an accumulation of corals making rock essentially under the reef over a certain period of time. Because, you know, if you go to Belize or the Great Barrier Reef, you really are looking at a long-term accumulation of coral skeletons. But if you go to the Lesser Antilles or to Hawaii, you find just essentially corals growing on basalt or, you know, basically rock that isn't coral derived. Ecologists will consider both of those coral reefs because the major organism that's involved in, you know, producing the topography of the bottom is coral. But, you know, at what point do we stop calling the Florida Keys reefs coral reefs when the, you know, proportion of bottom cover of coral is below 5%? What do we call them then? The Pleistocene reef underneath is actually made of coral. So do we still call it a coral reef? So you can see this is an issue that, but for the purposes of most ecologists, if there are any reef-building corals present, we call it a coral reef.
Okay, so getting now to some of the experimental techniques that scientists are using. First, Nikki Fogarty, tell us why scientists are pulling corals out of the ocean and looking at ways to preserve them in labs. Why aren't they just trying to preserve them in the ocean?
Yeah, this goes back to this kind of emergent disease, the stony coral tissue loss disease. So my colleagues down in the Florida Keys in South Florida have been trying to get ahead of the disease front and collect enough individuals of each species that's affected by this disease to bring them in to land-based nurseries to have a genetic stock, essentially. So eventually they could breed and restore the reefs is the hope. So we're in that dire of a situation, at least in the Florida Keys, that they're pulling the corals out of their natural environment in order to protect them, which is a really sad state of affairs.
And years ago, scientists would have gasped at that notion.
Absolutely, yeah. This is like rhinos, you know, where you go and get the last white rhino because it's the last one. I mean, this is where we are with Caribbean coral reefs.
We have a call. Anne from Wrightsville Beach asks, what is the impact of the crown of thorns on Caribbean reefs or on any of the reefs we're talking about?
Well, there are no crown of thorns, thankfully, in the Caribbean.
And so, tell our listeners what a crown of thorns is.
The crown of thorns is a sea star, a starfish. So it's an echinoderm in the same group as sea urchins and sea stars. It's very much a specialist predator on coral tissue, and it averts its gut on the surface of living corals and digests away the tissue. And it's had a pretty dramatic impact episodically on Indo-Pacific reefs. It's basically the reason why the Australian government founded its famous Australian Institute of Marine Sciences to study the outbreaks of crown of thorns starfish. But fortunately, we don't have them in the Caribbean. There was some concern that they might come across the Panama Canal, but that's never happened. And that was a big concern back when the Panama Canal was built, or early in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
We're in a minute or so, we're going to get into some of the ways that regular folks who are not studying these organisms might be able to make a difference in terms of helping to preserve them and the ecosystem in which they live. But Joe Pollack, you discovered that the distributions on Caribbean coral reefs determines their chemical defenses, and that affects whether fish eat the sponges. Can you just...
Oh, yeah. If you look at the community of sponges, there are some of them that have chemical defenses and others that don't. And what we've discovered is that in places where the predatory fishes are available on the reef, they eat the ones that are faster growing but do not produce defenses. So they won't eat the defended ones, but they love the ones that aren't defended, and they gobble them up.
What kinds of fish eat them?
Mostly angelfishes, but the biggest predator, it turns out, of sponges on Caribbean reefs are hawksbill turtles. And before Columbus reached the New World, we had 4 million hawksbill turtles.
How do you know that?
They can use captain's logs, and the captains kept very good logs of where turtles were nesting and how many turtles they took into their holds. And so you can essentially estimate the population of turtles based on the information that's in the British Museum.
So the proliferation then of these sponges, which is caused by the die-off of coral reefs, is actually saving the hawksbill turtles.
Well, we were down to 72,000 hawksbill turtles in 1974. So there is a tiny fraction. For every one that you see on the reef today, there were 400 previously. So they were having a huge impact on sponges on Caribbean coral reefs. And what that means is that they were probably eating all the sponges, not just the really palatable ones, the ones that aren't chemically defended. But back to your question, what we discovered was in the places that are overfished, the sponges grow rapidly and they overgrow the corals. The places that are protected from fishing, all you have are the defended species, and those are slow growing. And so those fishes are very important in keeping the sponges from overgrowing the corals.
So help us understand that. Which kinds of places right now are protected from overfishing that are demonstrating what you're talking about?
There are two types, really. There are the places where no one goes because they're too isolated. So these are the out islands of the Bahamas, those sorts of places. And then the places that are protected are like Bonaire and Curacao, places that have marine parks, also in the Bahamas, places where basically you can't fish. On the other hand, there are the places that have used intensive fishing practices like fish pots or fish traps, places like Jamaica, Martinique, St. Lucia. These are places that essentially you get in the water and you can't find a fish that's larger than a few inches in length because they've just completely stripped the reef of all the available fish.
What role do members of the public have in overfishing or not, or getting areas protected?
Well, you know, I think both Nikki and I would agree that if you're going on vacation to a place, a Caribbean island, that you should not choose the local fish as your you know, first choice of whatever dish that you're going to have if you're interested in protecting the reefs.
Surely one dinner of some good reef fish is not going to seriously impact that ecosystem, Joe Pollack.
Oh, definitely it will, because if everyone does that, the impact is going to be huge. And I think that many Caribbean nations are discovering that they really need to protect the fishes on their reefs and that they're more valuable to ecotourism than they are to what's on the plate. You know, better that they should grow tilapia or buy cod from somewhere else, although cod has its own problems. So, you know, a nice pelagic fish or something, yeah.
What is a pelagic fish?
The fishes that live out in the open water, things like mahi are pelagics that I think that is included in the species that are sustainable. Swordfish, no, but mahi, I think, are fine. So,
Nikki Fogarty, anything to add to that, just about the fish in terms of what people really should avoid when they're thinking about their own consumption and how that impacts the ecosystem?
You know, Joe did a great job covering fish. The other thing that is potentially an issue is our plastic use and all the plastics that go into the ecosystem. We're just scratching the surface of what microplastics do to coral reefs, and so that's pretty understudied at this point.
What do we know? Is there anything that we know about what microplastics do to coral reefs?
There have been some studies. They're just now coming out, and I'm not familiar with all the most recent ones. Most of the debris that kills coral reefs are discarded fishing traps, fishing gear, fishing line. So that's something definitely recreational fishermen and fisherwomen can do, is make sure you properly dispose of your fishing line so it doesn't get wrapped around the corals, sea turtles, sponges, etc. So little things like that can also help coral reefs.
We often hear, especially people who have been tourists in places, let's say around the Caribbean, you're taken either diving or snorkeling, and the tour guide says, don't step on the reef because you're going to kill it, and tourists don't listen to us and they keep killing the reefs. Oh, and your sunscreen is part of that too. How much a factor is that in terms of the die-off of coral reefs around the world or the Caribbean, Joe Pollack?
Well, it could be locally important on reefs that are heavily dived, but in a larger sense, probably of minimal impact. So if you're talking about a reef that gets hundreds of divers a day or snorkelers, there are certainly places like that, especially in Florida. Yes, the combined effect of sunscreens and the constant abrasion of corals by fins would have a big impact. But, you know, as far as reefs that are far from those areas or that get very limited visits from divers or snorkelers, the impact is not that great.
And you think the impact of ecotourism is actually good for the ecosystem that we're talking about. Can you lay out why?
Sure. A great example is what happened in Cozumel, which used to be heavily fished by local fishermen. And ecotourism took over. The fishermen decided that they could convert their fishing boats into diving vessels and bring tourists out to see the reef. And they wholesale changed from being fishermen to being running dive operations. And now they protect the reef. In fact, I have never been so roughly brought off the bottom as I was while diving in Cozumel. As a scientific diver, they didn't know that I was not in their group, and they actually grabbed me by the nape of the neck and pulled me off the reef. We were in the middle of doing some survey work. So they are—
Is fantastic.
They are aggressively protective of their reef now, and that's why the fish are coming back, the same fish that they previously extracted from the environment, they are now protecting because they know that's what bring the tourists back. So that's a great example of how tourism can provide a living to these people, and there's a feedback there of them wanting to protect their environment. Similarly, in Roatan, there's a local group that has shark dives. The same people who previously finned the sharks and killed them are now protecting them because they know it's a huge value to them to have these dives where tourists come and swim with the sharks.
So they're actually making more money taking people to see these creatures than they would if they were using them as products.
Exactly. And they'd be gone. And this way the populations are actually rebounding.
Nikki Fogarty, if you could dispel one myth about coral reefs that you think would really help people understand what we're talking about here, or leave people with one thought, what would that be?
That's a great question. I think the one thing that we need to understand is that we're in a dire situation right now. Coral reefs are dying worldwide. In some cases, the mortality is unprecedented. And although there's been some resistance to some of the radical ideas that scientists are proposing, I think it's time that we start considering these alternatives and these conservation aspects that might be seem a little scary or radical to some people. So I think we just need to kind of step up by stepping in and trying a variety of different methods, be it restoration, assisted evolution that some scientists are trying, management practices, and in order to tackle this very difficult problem.
And is there any hope that coral reefs might adapt to the warmer oceans?
There is. There are scientists that are starting to selectively breed corals at higher temperatures so those corals can do better in the future under warmer seawater conditions.
It sounds like there's a part two. That's this edition of Coastline. Nikki Fogarty, Joe Pollack, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Special thanks to Annabelle Crow. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.